Mayor Bloomberg says he'll be there. Join him. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
President-elect Barack Obama's choice to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Daschle, has been listening to the public in efforts to push through serious health care reform in the early days of the Obama administration. The president-elect's transition team set up thousands of meetings beginning on December 15th across the country to hear grievances about the health care system. At a meeting in Washington yesterday, Daschle said that the volume of people looking to participate is an indication of the degree of severity and concern that people have all over the country. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings every Saturday from 2 to 6, and beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. For centuries, at least for centuries, people searched for a way to determine whether someone was telling the truth or telling a lie. But it wasn't until the 1920s that someone came along claiming to have invented a foolproof machine to do just that. Despite overwhelming evidence that this instrument, the thing that we like to call the lie detector, is unreliable, Americans continue to put their faith in it to a degree much greater than those anywhere else in any other country. This morning, in this part of the show, we will explore something of the history and enduring power of the polygraph as we talk with historian Ken Alder about his recently published book, which is titled The Lie Detectors. The subtitle is The History of an American Obsession. Free Press is the publisher. He's an historian who's interested in science and technology. He is professor of history and Milton H. Wilson Professor of the Humanities at Northwestern University. And he's speaking with us from there. Well, Professor Alder, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, and yourself?
Quite well.
Thanks for talking with us. Just, I know this is terribly a pedestrian question to ask right at the beginning, but how is it that you became interested, you know, in all the various kinds of technologies that you might have looked in it, looked at? How did you become interested in exploring in some depth the history of the polygraph?
Well, I'm a historian of science, and I'm interested less in what most people usually think of as the big ideas of science, the ideas of Darwin and Einstein, and more in kind of the everyday science. In a way, I'm interested in the things we take for granted. And though I originally trained in French history, I became interested in the lie detector because it's uniquely American. In other words, I came to it from the outside looking in as what a strange thing that people would believe that this instrument would get at the truth. After all, that's something that we expect science to do, to get at the truth. And yet, to get at the truth about what people think using what is essentially a blood pressure monitor and a pulse rate measurer and something that measures a breathing depth struck me as sort of so surprising and yet so widely accepted that I became very curious about it.
Yeah. Well, this is it's an interesting story, and there are a lot of interesting personalities involved. But I guess that is the underlying question that is certainly worth exploring, and that is why it is that far more than any other country, we believe in this thing, in the idea that we can hook a person to a machine and that that machine can tell us absolutely one way or another, is the person telling the truth or not. You believe that somehow, I don't know if it's a It has to do with our faith in technology, or it has to do with our feeling that you can actually – things are that clear-cut. There's right, there's wrong, there's truth, there's falsehood. There's something distinctly American about our belief that There's a way to get an answer to those kinds of questions.
Absolutely. It's actually a conjunction of two things. In a way, there's a supply and a demand. There was a particular place where the lie detector first found lodging in the United States, and that was within the criminal justice system, which is quite unique in America. But the thing you're pointing to is equally important, which is the wider culture's acceptance of the lie detector. And it does turn on something you're pointing to, which is a kind of faith in machinery. And it's not, you know, that's uniquely American, but there is a way in which there is actually a kind of bright side, as it were, to this American faith in the lie detector. It points to something rather noble about our culture and our sense of justice even. Think about it this way. After all, here we are turning over this question about whether somebody is guilty or innocent, telling the truth or not, to something that's neutral, to a machine in a way, right? In the criminal justice system, we think of that kind of neutrality and kind of fairness as, in a sense, one of our, you know, highest achievements. We want justice to be dispassionate. And what could be more dispassionate, in a sense, than a machine, right? It wouldn't have prejudice. It wouldn't prejudge the situation. And so there was a sense in which, in turning to the machine, people were sort of holding up an ideal of justice as fairness.
Yeah. Well, there are three, four individuals that are at the heart of this story. And so I'd like to give you an opportunity here to talk about them and about their relationship with one another, because that's essentially what the lie detectors is all about. And maybe we start with this man named John Larson. He was a rookie police officer in Berkeley, California, who also happened to have a PhD in psychology. And he was the first guy to rig up what we would recognize as being a lie detector and try to use that to determine guilt or innocence in a particular crime.
Yeah, that's right. It was in the early 1920s in Berkeley, California, and he was a PhD scientist, but he had taken a job as a cop. He was interested in the forensic sciences, and he had taken a job as a cop with the Berkeley Police Force, whose chief was a man named August Vollmer. Berkeley, not a particularly important town on the national scene in some ways, but in other ways, this man, August Vollmer, is probably the most important police officer in modern American history, because he's really the father of modern professional policing. And he believed that cops should use science to solve crimes and that cops should be, in a sense, professionals about it. And he brought Larson onto the force. And there, Larson came up with this idea of using a set of physiological apparatus. Really, what's interesting is that the technology itself is not particularly new. It's off-the-shelf sort of stuff, even in the 1920s, you know, a blood pressure monitor, a pulse rate measurer, and measures something that measures your breathing depth. But what Larson's real stroke of kind of genius was he found a perfect way to sort of test this new apparatus while he interrogated suspects. What he was looking for was a kind of experimental setup where he could see if it worked by taking a crime, a real crime, something people would lie about that was important to them. When, you know, you were asking the possibly guilty person whether they'd done it or not. And yet he wanted to have controls. He wanted to be able to know that some of the people were innocent and one was guilty. So he looked for a crime where it was an inside job, and he wanted a relatively homogeneous population, one where everyone was healthy, one where people would basically follow instructions more or less as expected. And so what he did was he set out to investigate crimes in Berkeley sororities. And he would go to various sororities and where there'd been inside jobs, stolen dresses, stolen rings or other money, and do interrogations. In fact, the very first case was that ever the lie detector was used in successfully was such a case in a sorority. Mm-hmm. What was sort of interesting about it is as he began with the innocent victim or the presumptively innocent victim of the crime, a woman who had lost a diamond ring, as his control, and then worked his way through a series of the young women in the dorm in the sorority. And when he finally got to one, she was so infuriated by the question, so outraged at being confronted in this way, she stood up from the chair, ripped off all the apparatus, and stormed out of the room. The police then tailed her, and a few days later, she came in and confessed to the crime. And in a sense, the lie detector has worked that way ever since. It had, in a sense, tightened the psychological screws and elicited a confession from this woman. The lie detector didn't, in fact, solve this crime by showing that she had lied, but by driving her to the point where she admitted to it. There are two, then, interesting outcomes of this case, just to follow it up. It really is exemplary of everything that will happen to lie detector in the future, in a way. The first is that Larson ends up marrying the first woman he interrogated, that innocent victim of the crime. Mm-hmm. He brought her back in for further testing, and in the course of trying to determine whether she was responding to him or to the questions, asked her if she cared for him, and they ended up getting married within the year. But the more interesting thing is that Larson, in a way, began to doubt that, in fact, he had nabbed the right woman and accused the right woman who confessed to the crime. In fact, she retracted this woman who confessed the crime, retracted her confession shortly thereafter, and always later claimed her innocence. And Larson began to wonder whether, in fact, all he had measured was not whether she was guilty, but whether she had simply felt guilty.
Yeah. Well, and that points at what is the central problem, question, reason for doubt about the whole enterprise, that what the polygraph does is it measures stress. It measures the person's discomfort. Well, the whole experience of being of going through a polygraph test, I'm sure for a lot of people, is stressful and uncomfortable, and that might well lead you to a lot of false positives. And also, if you get someone who is a really good liar, that we know that someone like that can beat the test.
All of that's exactly right. One of the things it points to, then, is the way that there's a kind of misdirect, what a magicians will call misdirect, at the core of this form of lie detection, which is people focus on the apparatus, the hardware, let's call it, of lie detection. But the real skill and the real, as it were, technology of lie detection lies in the way the questions are framed and the sort of whole interrogation setup. And it's in distinguishing between people's obviously very anxious responses when they're being interrogated about a serious matter, even if they're innocent, from those responses when the person happens to be guilty, that therein lies the art of lie detection. And various forms of questioning techniques have been developed to try to make that distinction. But as you point out, large numbers of false positives are still regularly produced.
Yeah. One of the results of this particular case was that it got a lot of attention in the press there in California, as well as the story about how it is that Larson met his wife and ended up marrying this young woman who was a student there at the university. That got a lot of press. The newspapers loved that story. So here, in the popular imagination now, the idea of the lie detector, the fact that there is this machine and you can hook somebody up to it and you can tell whether they're telling the truth or not, the very idea of it gets born, and people apparently really like the idea, and they thought, well, that sounds pretty cool. That's a good thing. And we're ready to believe that such a thing was possible and such a thing would work.
Yeah, it's the press that names it or dubs it the lie detector. That's something that the newspapers give it as a name. And Larson is never very happy about that. But it speaks to a kind of moment. I mean, this is sort of the era of the true crime. A lot of newspapers are sold on the basis of these sort of exposés of crime, with the reporter, in a sense, as a kind of rival to the police, as the honest investigator of corruption and criminality. And the lie detector sort of gave the reader of the newspaper, you know, via the press accounts, a kind of voyeuristic tour of the criminal mind to see the truth of the matter. It allowed sort of the entire reading public to sit in as a kind of jury before a jury was seated, which was, in a sense, part of the problem with the lie detector.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ken Alder. He is a professor of history at Northwestern University and has authored a new book that looks at the history of the thing that we call the lie detector, the polygraph, and why it is that in this country particularly we seem to be so interested in and willing to believe that such a thing will do what is promised, that is, tell us who's telling the truth and who is lying. The subtitle of his book is The History of an American Obsession, and it's published by the Free Press. The book's out now. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Well, apparently John Larson got the idea to try this out after having read some work that had been done by a psychologist at Harvard. This man, his name is William Marston. And apparently early on in his career at Harvard, he was doing some experimenting, and he discovered that people's blood pressure went up when they lied. And Larson had seen that work, and he thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And so he took that and built on it. And apparently all the attention focused on Larson got Marston to say, hey, there's something here. I'm going to – he got back into doing that kind of work. He started doing – developed a machine. He started doing this in criminal cases. And there's one case that he was involved in, and it's interesting because – it seemed to be the point at which and ever after in criminal cases, judges said, no, we're not going to admit this as evidence. It was a case that he got involved in, a case of a man, a young African-American man who was charged with murder, confessed, later recanted, was convicted. Marston had tested him and apparently believed that he was not guilty, or at least believed that there was doubt, and wanted to – the defense wanted to call – wanted to put Marston on stand as an expert witness in his defense. And the judge – this was 1923. The judge said no because this is an – at least what he said was, well, this is an unproven technology. I mean, who knows? You know. And so he said, I'm not going to allow you to testify. And essentially from that point on, it's never been admissible in court for all this time. Maybe you might talk a little bit about this Marston is another one of these three, four guys that are really very important in this story. And tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, he's an incredible character. He's most famous to sort of jump toward the end of his life before I back up and sort of tell you where he came from. He's most famous in the end for creating the cartoon character Wonder Woman, which is quite a second act to an American career.
Yep, really.
Yeah. But in this early days in the 1920s, and there is a connection between these two acts of his life, but in this first act of his life, yeah, you're right. This Fry case is incredibly important because it doesn't actually just, as a precedent, concern the lie detector. It's used as a precedent to decide what science will get into courtrooms throughout the United States for the next 50, 60 years, all forms of science. It becomes what's called the – what's extracted from this case is something called the Fry Rule, where basically the courts say, you know, from now on we're going to let into criminal trials only science that has been accepted by the relevant community. In other words, judges aren't themselves going to be able to decide what counts as good science or not. They're going to turn to the relevant community of scientists. And they actually take, in this first case, sort of just judicial notice that this is very new and doesn't seem very plausible. But then in a few years later, they go out and poll academic psychologists to find out whether or not they agree that it meets their standards. And most say no, and so the lie detector is banned. But that raises some interesting questions. I mean, Marston continues to sort of try to get introduced to trials. And, you know, there are plenty of other sciences that do get into the courtroom that aren't, you know, necessarily all that much more reliable than lie detectors. And one of the things that has always been a real sort of sometimes hidden but sometimes openly acknowledged problem with lie detection is it goes to the problem directly of the guilt or innocence of the defendant. And if you do have a lie detector and you did believe it worked, what would you need a jury for? And Marston, in a sense, was trying to make a bid to replace the jury with the lie detector. He wanted to sort of make it a more scientific procedure. And that really was why the courts resisted it so much. Marston himself, though, did conduct tests in sororities. This seemed to be partially borrowing the idea from Larson. And there he discovered, he sort of got sidetracked in a different part of his career in a way. Using his lie detector in sororities, he began to discover that what we call the garden variety emotions of fear and jealousy and love were in fact just the surface manifestations of deeper emotions structured around submission and dominance. And he began to pursue this theory, especially in a sort of his particular version of it was that people enjoy submitting to powerful women. Both men and women enjoy submitting to powerful women. And that leads him into the creation of Wonder Woman. Many years later, he becomes a critic of comics. He's brought on board to All-American Comics. And there, challenges the board to say, you know, I can create a female superhero, something that had never been done before successfully, and goes out and actually creates the cartoon character Wonder Woman, where the premise of the early comics is, you know, this is a wonderful icon. This is the sort of power to which Americans should want to submit. And many of Wonder Woman's early battles, of course, in the late 30s and early 1940s when she's first created, are with the fascists. And Marston does this incredible job of sort of showing how Wonder Woman represents the kind of power to which we should want to submit, as opposed to dark fascist powers.
We're getting close to our midpoint here, and again, I'd just like to introduce and welcome callers. Our guest is Ken Alder. He's professor of history at Northwestern. He's interested in history of science and technology. He's the author of this new book that is the history of the polygraph. The title is The Lie Detectors, The History of an American Obsession, and it's published by the Free Press, and questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Now, okay, let's bring in another character here, someone who connects to the story, really, I think, connects to the story through August Vollmer, the man that you talked about, who was the man who at one time was the police chief there in Berkeley, who was very concerned with professionalizing policing, modernizing methods, who really liked the idea of the lie detector as a tool for investigation and interrogation. So rather than rough somebody up, that you'd hook them up to the machine and you could easily tell, you know, were they guilty or not. And this fourth man is a fellow named Leonard Keeler, who, among other things, refined the device, helped to develop something that was easily portable, that worked better. He was the guy, apparently, who coined the term polygraph, and was someone who then probably for the rest of his life was a great rival of John Larson, the first man that we talked about. The two of them having very different personalities, being very competitive, and perhaps also having very different ideas about what the polygraph could do and should do.
Yeah, exactly. Leonard Keeler was a high school student when he began to work for the Berkeley police, helping out with cases. His father was a friend of August Vollmer, the police chief. It was simple as that. It was sort of daddy's connection. Mm-hmm. And but he got fascinated by the lie detector. And he basically does sort of get this first early patent on a simplified device. And it's this sort of generic, easily transportable, readily easily made lie detector that becomes the industry standard very quickly. And more important again than the technology is how Keeler developed these interrogation techniques that were designed to intensify the experience of being interrogated to the point where people would confess to crimes. He basically took the same ambiguities that had so troubled Larson in that first case and in subsequent cases, the ambiguities of whether a person was guilty or merely felt guilty, and Keeler pushed those buttons as hard as he could. And in a way, one of the things that happened was this made the device acceptable to the police. In a way, that's the important part of the story that's particularly American, is the lie detector, as we just explained, was banned from the courtroom, right? Mm-hmm. It was banned from being used in evidence in criminal courts. But that didn't mean it was banned from use in criminal investigations. A very unique part of the American justice system is increasingly in this period, very few cases come to trial. Already it's about 70% of criminal indictments, and this is in the 20s and 30s, result in a trial. They begin at that point, this huge ramp up in the number of plea bargains. And plea bargain is a kind of bluff and bluster game between cops and prosecutors on one side and defendants and lawyers, if they have lawyer, on the other. And this is in the 20s and 30s, where not everyone might have. And in this sort of bluff and bluster game, the lie detector became a kind of a tool of both intimidation and vetting, so the prosecutors decide which cases to pursue or not. And it really thrives in that environment, in a way shapes that environment. And so even though it's banned from the court, what Keeler shows is that the lie detector can be used as an incredible tool of, you know, this new criminal justice system that's taking shape in 20th century America. Really, one that most of the public really is still not all that aware of, right? Most people think of criminal trials, but they're only a tiny percentage of how justice gets done.
And it seemed that one of the big differences between, you know, aside from the fact that there were very different personalities between Keeler and Larson, is that Larson perhaps had more reservations about the technology. He thought that it was a kind of thing that could be a very useful tool as part of investigations of human psychology and perhaps of criminals, but that he did continue to have reservations. And Keeler was much more, at least it seemed like he was much more solid about the reliability of it, the ability of the machine to separate the guilty from the innocent. And I suppose also one of the big differences is that Keeler enjoyed being a celebrity, and I don't know that Larson particularly did.
Yeah. No, Keeler was brilliant at drumming up publicity, and in a way that was part of his strategy. In a way, it was a commercial interest. I mean, after high school, he went to Stanford, eventually got his degree as an undergraduate. He's never much of a student or scholar. But basically, he was in a kind of consulting business and made his money by selling machines and by selling his services. And he, you know, drumming up publicity was key to his success. It also wasn't just his personal success. It made the lie detector that much more effective. It was essential to his using the lie detector successfully to extract confessions that people believed that the lie detector worked. And so he did that in several ways. One was general publicity about the lie detector, and then there were some specific interrogation techniques he used. One of them, really important, still used to this day, which he called the card test or card trick. And basically, it's very simple. You strap the person to the lie detector. As an interrogator, you then, you know, give them a bunch of cards and playing cards and tell them to pick one, any one, look at it, memorize it, put it back in the deck, and then ask the person being interrogated to deny in each instance as you flip over the card that this is their card. At one point, of course, they'll lie when you get to, say, the four of hearts, whichever it would be, they're to lie. And then on the basis of the graphical record alone, this examiner will then show the subject that they can actually pick out when they lied, that it was in fact the four of hearts. And this has several purposes. One, of course, you've gotten the subject to tell a lie. So that's a useful data point comparison for later on. But more to the point, you convinced the subject that you can catch them telling a lie, and that makes them that much more anxious you'll catch them later on and that much more likely to spill. In fact, to make sure this trick worked, Keeler, who is a very good amateur magician, always marked the deck so that he would never miss. And actually, interesting story about how he met his wife. He met her while playing this card trick. She was also a fellow undergraduate at Stanford, a fellow psych major. And actually, she beat the card trick, in a sense, first time out, because she cheated right back. She didn't look at the card. And I'm sorry to report that she later cheated on Keeler and left him for another man in the end, and really kind of broke his heart in the latter half of his life.
Yeah, well, that's another really interesting parallel between the lives of Keeler and Larson. They both met their wives over the polygraph.
Yeah, and actually so did Marston. Marston met both his wife when she conducted tests with him at Harvard when they were both undergraduates. And then he met his sort of co-wife, second wife. He lives in a ménage à trois his entire life, Marston. And he met his wife while conducting those tests in the sorority also. So there's something about this box, this lie detector, that gives people – it's got an erotic charge, this idea that you can look inside somebody else and see their secret thoughts. But it had a dark side as well, which was that it made all these men rather paranoid. I mean, it heightens a sense of mistrust. You sort of you know, you're walking around with this box and you sort of think that it can sort out truth tellers from liars, and you begin to wonder how honest everyone is being with you when you don't have the box on.
Mm. So you think that if we were talking about some other device, that is, if we were talking about competing developers of the Xerox machine or something like that, that the rivalry might not have been quite so intense?
Yeah, I think people fight about priority in science a lot, and to some extent that was part of what Keeler and Larson and Marston all argued about, in that in almost all of the famous scientific discoveries, you know, there's always a parallel, simultaneous or near simultaneous discovery, and people will argue, you know, quite bitterly about who came first, not partially because, of course, you get credit for being first, and the second person may have copied, right? And so there's a huge emphasis in science on priority. But it's not just that. It's not just who got there first. It's usually rival interpretations of what was done. And to some extent, that's what's interesting about this case. In my book, I really set Keeler and Larson, you know, side by side, in part because they really are the movers and shakers that create the lie detector. But then they're arguing about what the lie detector should be. What kind of lie detector should we have? And in your question earlier, you pointed exactly at that. Larson has a different take. Mm. Larson thinks the lie detector should be a tool, sure, for psychological exploration. Think of, you know, biofeedback, or think of the ways that it might be useful to measure somebody's physiological responses while they answer questions. For Keeler, however, it really is a tool of criminal justice and a tool to force the issue, to force a confession.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation here where we are in Champaign County. Let's do that. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Interesting that incidental fact that you brought out, that the sort of plea bargaining and intimidation has not a new development. I've always thought of that as actually coming around lately, but I guess it came up with the lie detector in some ways and before that. I wanted to know if you looked into sort of the media, particularly entertainment portrayal of lie detectors, and whether that might have something to do, besides America's fascination with technology and technological fixes, that there was in the 30s, Hoover actually had a blue pencil, I guess they called it, for G-Man, and after that the FBI film series, and was always able to persuade the Hollywood people to depict the FBI in good lights, and was able to sort of censor any depictions that he didn't like. Amazing power, and somewhat uncommented on, but I just vaguely sort of remember from my youth these images of the police shows and the depiction of the efficacy of the lie detector, and I'm wondering whether that's more culture than science and technology, but I'm wondering whether you might have looked at that. And as I'm off, I'll listen on the air. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah. No, it's a great question. Absolutely. First of all, that plea bargaining is it even has its beginnings in the 19th century, and it really picks up steam in the 20s and 30s. Yeah, it has a long history. As for your other question, absolutely. The lie detector, obviously picked up by the sort of print media and the newspapers in the 20s and 30s. But begins to appear very quickly in movies, even in a silent movie. The very first depiction of the lie detector on film dates to 1926, when a very popular police series, a silent movie, you know, 10-part series, is filmed in Berkeley, California, using August Vollmer playing himself and using the lie detector to solve crimes, all the way through Leonard Keeler playing himself in a Hollywood movie in the late 40s called Call Northside 777, starring Jimmy Stewart, and based on a true story of using the lie detector to exonerate, all the way to Meet the Parents and, you know, current releases. But yes, in a funny way, think of those shows that are quite popular on television where, you know, either it's a dating show or a show of sometimes with some sort of criminal element, where a person is brought onto the show and interrogated in front of the studio audience on the lie detector. And you might think, and most people who work in polygraph sort of sciences would say, oh, this is a corruption of our science and a corruption of our professional ethics. Actually, I think this is the lie detector in its natural setting. This is the lie detector. It is a kind of piece of theater. It's sometimes a theater designed for one when that one person is the subject and they're being convinced that science has caught them out and they're being sort of convinced that they should confess the crime. And Keeler was incredibly successful at getting confessions. I should point that out. He would get confession rates among people he accused of crimes of 60%. Now, we don't know how many of those confessions were false, because clearly there are such things as false confessions produced by lie detection. It does happen for sure. But that sort of sense of it as a show, as a theater, is something that, you know, pervades the way lie detectors are used in the political culture to this day. From Anita Hill taking a lie detector test to, you know, Gary Condit. You remember the representative accused of possibly having some involvement with the death of his intern. And he was sort of eventually took a lie detector test in sort of to exonerate himself. It becomes a kind of public theater, a kind of rite that we do to sort of show our innocence or display our innocence.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Ken Alder, he's professor of history at Northwestern University, author of a book that explores the history of the lie detector, and it is titled The Lie Detectors, published by the Free Press. Questions, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Because there was the lie detector got so much attention, I'm sure that there were a lot of people who thought, well, this is a pretty good business to be in the lie detector business, and tried to launch competing devices. One that you talk about in the book was a fellow named Dr. Orlando Scott, who was a competitor in the lie detection to these other guys that we've talked about. He claimed to have a device that measured brain waves to detect whether someone was telling the truth or not.
Yeah. I mean, actually, of course, there are techniques coming on the market now, and actually they've been around for about 20, 30 years that do try to measure brain activity as a sign of lying. But Orlando Scott was a charlatan, I mean, flat out. He basically was really – what he was really measuring was people's sweatiness, but he hooked the electrodes up to the backs of their neck and the sides of their head and the like and purported to be reading their brain waves. And in a way, he took Keeler's style of theater, the logic of the way Keeler designed, I mean, the sort of the premises of Keeler's work, and took it to their logical extreme where there was, you know, almost no connection to, you know, real physiological measurements of any kind. It was pure show. And he was very successful at it, and partially because he was a physician, he was actually able, in certain civil cases, to get his evidence introduced into the court.
As we pointed out, we talked a little bit about the Frye rule, this going all the way back to this case that Marston was involved in 1923, mm-hmm. where the defense wanted to bring him in to testify as to the innocence of a man who was accused of murder, and where the judge said, well, we really don't know about this technology. We're not so sure about it. We're not going to allow that. And that it's in criminal cases in court, it's still not accepted. Polygraph evidence is still not accepted. However, as you point out, in law enforcement, it continues to be used to try to determine guilt or innocence. There are cases where private companies have used polygraph to try to find out whether their employees or potential employees are honest. It's been used to try to gauge the honesty and security worthiness of federal employees who were dealing with government secrets. So it seems that odd that on the one hand, in the courtroom, we've said this is not reliable, so we certainly don't want to bring this into the courtroom. And on the other hand, we have in many cases used it as if we believed that it could tell us whether somebody was honest or whether somebody was going to sell secrets to the Russians. We have this odd sort of split mind about this, whether we can't seem to really make up our mind whether we believe it or whether we don't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The Supreme Court has occasionally wrestled with it, but they've never resolved it. I mean, there was a Supreme Court case about 10 years back when the question of polygraphs came before the court, and they kind of saw a lot of them noted this disjuncture between what they allow in all the domains outside of the criminal court and the way they nonetheless sort of more or less forbid it in criminal courts. But they kind of punted on that one and really didn't try to resolve the problem. They just noted that, you know, if somebody want – if a legislature wanted to ban it from the court or if the judges wanted to ban it from the court, they could. And they didn't go to the question. It's used, as you pointed out, very often in national security settings. Until the last few months, it had been used extensively at Los Alamos and Livermore and the other national weapons labs to vet scientists. This was a result of the Wen-Ho Lee case where a Los Alamos scientist was accused of selling nuclear secrets to China in 1999. And he had taken a lie detector test, was obliged to, had been told that he had failed it. The American public was told that he had failed it. And, of course, he was then, you know, put in irons, literally in irons, in solitary confinement. And, of course, a year later, all the charges against him had to be dropped as essentially false. And what's more, it turned out he had probably not failed the lie detector test. And, in fact, it is a standard technique. Rather than this some sort of being some unusual case, this is exactly how lie detector techniques are used all the time. People are told they failed the test, or the American public is told somebody's failed the test, when that is not, in fact, the case at all. You know, cops are allowed to lie when they interrogate people. That is a legitimate, you know, the Supreme Court has consistently ruled that they're allowed to deceive in certain ways. So the lie detector lives in that world outside of the courtroom where deception is part of the process. And it, you know, it has troubled a great number of, you know, serious scientists. So the National Academy of Sciences in 2003, fairly recently, conducted a really quite brilliant study of a survey of all the studies that have been done on lie detection and concluded it's really ineffective, and yet we're still using it. Maybe it's distracting us from more effective ways of finding out whether, you know, somebody is telling the truth by, you know, getting the usual kinds of corroborative evidence. Hmm.
Do you have any rough idea who now in the United States, how many people are in the business of giving, of using the polygraph, giving lie detector tests?
It's hard to say, you know. It's a very unregulated business. In a sense, for lie detection to work the way, you know, Keeler designed it with, you know, deception of the subject as part of how you get the kind of confession results you want, they're consummate unprofessionals. And there are some various, you know, societies that some of them belong to. Rough guesses are on the order of 5,000, 10,000 people. And at their height in the late 1980s, there were probably about 2 million tests being administered each year in the United States. I should point out that since then there's been probably a drop-off. Nobody knows the exact numbers because a law was passed in 1988 limiting the ability of employers to oblige their employees to take tests.
Hmm. Is there still research being done? People who are looking for something like this, that is some reliable physiological measure so that you could, in theory, hook somebody to some kind of machine and tell whether or not he or she is telling the truth or lying.
Yeah, well, there are two things to say about that. The first is what's amazing is that since the 1920s until quite recently, this technology has been remarkably stable. It has not changed at all. Hmm. And considering how much scientific progress there's been in the last 8 years, you might think that's surprising. But maybe it's not if you think about the fact that the lie detector succeeds through a kind of ruse by tricking people into thinking that, you know, they're getting caught, whether or not they are. So what's inside the box, as it were, hardly matters. So that's, in a sense, why it, you know, hasn't been really worth anybody's time to really try to fiddle or improve the machinery. However, in the last, say, decade, there has been a push, in part fueled, you know, more recently still by the events of 9/11 and, you know, new concern with interrogation, especially of, you know, potential terrorists, for new techniques that would look directly at the brain activity as a way to potentially measure deception. This plays off new kinds of technologies that have just come in within the last decade, especially the MRI. That's a magnetic resonance imaging technique. And what it can do is measure activity in different parts of the brain. And on the basis of this, and some very small studies have been conducted in laboratory settings using these devices, there's some of these researchers believe they will be able to develop techniques that, by showing that somebody uses the, say, the memory part of their brain extensively, this shows that, you know, they're remembering whatever's being discussed, and on that basis you could tell whether they were lying if they denied, you know, something about that event, right? Mm-hmm. So the problem with that is, and this will be a huge problem with this new technology, is, you know, liars use their memory a lot too, as well as people who are remembering true events. And the problem, as Montaigne, the French essayist, pointed out 400 years ago, life would be very simple if the opposite of the truth had a single face, because then you could just, you know, when somebody was, the opposite of their lie would be the truth. It isn't that simple. There are 100,000 different kinds of lies. They're lies we make up on the fly. They're lies we rehearse. Lying takes so many different forms. It's such an intrinsic part of, you know, human social life that it's going to be very hard to just look at somebody's brain activity and figure out whether or not they were telling the truth and distinguish it from the lies.
Mm-hmm. And again, coming around to where we started, that is one of the things that sounds as if interested you, the fact that perhaps here in the United States we would prefer to believe that it is a much more clear-cut, black and white, ironclad, there's truth, there's a lie kind of situation, that's something that can indeed be determined. And because we have a kind of attachment to and belief in technology, that's why we have so long and continue to believe that a machine can do this. We can make a machine can do this, and it can distinguish between, you know, A, the truth, and B, the lie, and that it can be as clear-cut as that.
Yeah, and I think we also have a very high premium in our culture. I mean, you could in some ways, you know, find its origins in, you know, Puritan times, but it's been reinforced in many ways since then. A high premium in our culture placed on public avowals of sincerity. You know, whether it's, you know, in the McCarthyite period and loyalty oaths, or the idea that standing up and speaking the truth in that sort of public and sincere way, you know, is central to, you know, what we expect of our public figures. And that isn't necessarily the case in other countries, right? It isn't this sort of public confession or, you know, open avowals are so widely, you know, shared by other cultures. It really is something unique to the United States. And then you couple that with exactly what you pointed out, right? This idea that the machine would do the judging, that it would be dispassionate and measure and gauge this sort of emotional sincerity as well as sort of logic of, you know, truthful sense.
Yeah. We're coming down here. We have a couple of minutes left. Maybe you could say something about particularly Keeler and Larson, how their lives ended up. Keeler died relatively young, had a lot of problems, never, I guess, quite got over the fact that his wife left him. Neither of these men seem to have particularly happy lives.
No. They really this box became a burden. It became really something that the sort of sense of mistrust that it bred in them did, in a sense, ruin their lives. Larson spent his entire career, as he put it, trying to kill the Frankenstein's monster. He phrased it in those very terms that he had created. And in a sense, the Frankenstein's monster was the lie detector, but it was also Keeler, who he had initially trained and introduced to the field and really had an incredible antipathy for Keeler, and felt he was a charlatan and it ruined, you know, the possibility of a science of lie detection. And so though Larson lives into the 60s, he dies a very bitter, quite a bitter man. Keeler, died really quite young. He was in his mid-40s when he died. He became an alcoholic and was, you know, terribly distraught by his wife's betrayal, drowned his solace in drink. And really, in a sense, sort of just was undone by his own sort of mistrust of the people around him. He became very, very sort of dark in his latter years. It was really quite a tragic tale. The irony is the one that lived and happiest was Marston with his ménage à trois and his creation of Wonder Woman. He didn't live a particularly long life. I think he died in his mid-50s, but he seems to have been an incredibly happy figure. And one of the things that struck me about it is he got the lie detector for what it was. I think he always understood thoroughly that it was a kind of show. He really understood that it was a sort of a way to speak to America about itself. And he would, in various sort of popular magazines, do interrogations of people on lie detectors, wives, to see if they could resolve their relationships with their husbands. I mean, he used it in Gillette shaving ads to show that it made – that Gillette blades were more relaxing than other forms of blades. I mean, he really – sort of the Madison Avenue kind of person he was made him at home with the lie detector, and he really understood the kind of way it sort of matched the America of his own era.
Yeah. Well, this is a great story. It's very interesting, some unique personalities, and I would certainly suggest if folks want to read more, you look for the book. The title is The Lie Detectors, The History of an American Obsession. It's published by the Free Press by our guest, Ken Alder. He's professor of history and the Milton H. Wilson Professor of the Humanities at Northwestern University. Professor Alder, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Institute has now established the Center for Men and Masculinity, aimed at research, clinical services, and education about boys and men. Information at menandmasculinity.com.
You've been listening to AM 580 all year long to keep up with the economy, the saga of Illinois' governor, the elections. You've listened to Car Talk, Morning Edition, Focus 580, and you're listening now. Everything you hear on AM 580 is made possible by listener contributions. If you haven't given recently, please do so today. Your contribution is tax deductible in 2008, but only if you give today. Log on to willpledge.org.
Evolution's crooked pathway on today's Moment of Science. What does survival of the fittest mean? Imagine that some predatory animal happens to be born with slightly better vision than average. This improved vision will give it an advantage while hunting, so it'll be more likely to survive and pass on the genes for that good eyesight to future generations. Eventually, the individuals with good eyesight genes will dominate over those without them, and the species as a whole will change, becoming more fit. This simple example is a pretty good description of how evolution works. Unfortunately, nature is rarely so simple. The same genes can often control more than one physical trait at a time. For instance, what would happen if the good eyesight genes in our example also resulted in purple toes? Our hunters would have to evolve this extra trait too, despite the fact that it doesn't necessarily make them any fitter than before. While purple-toed, keen-eyed hunters are just a made-up example, a real animal that demonstrates this is the three-spined stickleback fish of western Canada. These fish moved into glacier-carved lakes 13,000 years ago. Over time, they evolved into two separate species. The original is short and thin and has a small mouth, while the other is long, fat, and wide-mouthed. Why did they evolve this way? Biologist Dolph Schluter discovered that all three traits, length, thickness, and mouth size, are linked together on the same genes. Although the fittest possible stickleback might be both slender and wide-mouthed, these linked traits make such an evolutionary jump unlikely. So evolution doesn't always take the straight road to fitness. It often detours along a crooked path. This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Brabson Foundation. Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from William Rowland. I'm Yael Cassander.
This is WILL, AM 580 and FM 90.9, HD2 and HD3, Urbana.